Alan Dickon is from McMaster University, and he will talk to us on the unusual title here of, let's see, get this in here, full screen mode. Okay, got it? Got to read your title. Uncreation, Recreation, Creation, a New Theory for the Origins of Genesis 1. Take it away.
Okay, thanks a lot. Thank you. Let me just see. Okay, it's working. So, thanks for coming to the session. And I took some effort to try to see if these ideas have been proposed before, and I can't find that they have been. So I need your feedback on what it sounds to you like. Okay, so, if I can start with a quote from C.S. Lewis. He was speaking about life in general before his conversion, but it seems to me to be very pertinent for Genesis 1. The two hemispheres of my mind were in sharpest contrast. On the one side, a many islanded sea of poetry and myth. On the other, a glib and shallow rationalism. Nearly all that I loved, I believed to be imaginary. Nearly all that I believed to be real, I thought grim and meaningless. For example, I could say two views of creation. Is it to be the majesty and poetry of Genesis 1? God said, let there be light, and there was light, and God saw the light was good. Or billions of years of death and destruction. This is the dilemma. So let us say, suppose the earth really was created in 6 days. How would we know that? Because man was not made till the sixth day. So if a man heard the divine words of creation, let there be light, then he must have heard it in a vision, I'd say. But in that case, Genesis 1 is describing the vision rather than the creation. Well, that might take some argument. So hold that thought and we come back to it. Then again, supposing there really were two people called Adam and Eve, how would we know about them since they lived before the invention of writing? So if their story was passed down to us, it must have been orally. But in that case, why is their account different from Genesis 1? This leads us to the proposition that there are two creation stories with a different initial state and different orders of creation. Genesis 1, first water, then plants, then animals, then man and woman. Genesis 2 in the AV, authorized version, dust and then man and then plants, then animals and then women. This is evidence for two parallel traditions. The NIV tries to conceal the conflict by saying, now the Lord God had planted a garden in the east in Eden. Now the Lord God had formed out of the ground all the beasts of the field and the birds of the air. Frankly, that's nearly heresy to mistranslate in that way, to try to conceal the fact that these two stories are different. And then, okay, so supposing Genesis 2 was actually the original creation story. So we begin Genesis 2, 4b. When the Lord God made the earth and the heavens, no shrub of the field had yet appeared on the earth, no plant of the field had yet sprung up. The Lord had not yet, as implied, sent rain on the earth, and there was no man yet to work the ground. So these not yet phrases, they're very typical in Mesopotamian literature of the opening, the beginning of a myth or an epic. For example, in Enuma Elish, when skies above were not yet named, when yet no gods were manifest. So the not yet phrase is a message. This is the beginning of the Bible. Okay, so we can see many features in Genesis 2 that are similar to Mesopotamian creation myths, specifically the Eridu cosmology, which was identified with the god there shown as Enki, the god of living water. So we have creation of man out of earth, like say dust or clay, the importance of the two great rivers, which are shown, those are the flowing streams flowing out of the vases, the importance of subterranean fresh water, those are the vases underneath the god's throne, an anthropogenic deity, which is seen in Genesis 2, and a deity who plans the environment that man's going to live in. So these are all commonalities between Genesis 2 and Mesopotamian literature. Okay, so supposing Genesis 2 really is an authentic story of origins, then if the world was destroyed in the flood, if the known world was destroyed in the flood, then Genesis 2 was passed down by Noah on the ark. But it's not realistic that Noah had two oral accounts which describe creation in a different order, because that's really basically a conflict in terms of what happened. So we infer from that that Genesis 1 was revealed after the flood. Well, you might say, well, yeah, I know that. It was revealed thousands of years after the flood. But we can also argue that Genesis 1 predates the Mosaic Covenant. The fourth commandment, says, in 6 days the Lord made the heavens, the earth, the sea, and all that is in them. But he rests on the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and made it holy. So the fourth commandment is supposedly written by the finger of God on Mount Sinai. It presupposes the creation story, and we have evidence that even before the revelation of the Sinai covenant, the Israelites were observing the Sabbath, because the story about the manna that was going to keep for 2 days only on the day before the Sabbath. So the implication then is that the creation story was widely circulated before the Exodus. That's my conclusion anyway. So how about a Mesopotamian origin for Genesis 1? It's often been argued that Genesis 1 originates from the Enuma Elish, as I quoted at the beginning before. There's lots of reasons against this. The first one I haven't listed here is Enuma Elish is quite a late work. It glorifies the god Marduk, who was anathema to the Israelites. Marduk was an upstart god, like the Canaanite god Baal. The cosmic battle theme, which of course is well seen in regard to Baal, the cosmic battle theme is a device specifically used to justify the ascendancy of an upstart god. Therefore, we can see that the cosmic battle theme is politically motivated. It's a strategy to justify abandoning the old gods, which the people believed in, and adopting the new upstart god in response to human conquest. In the case of Marduk, it was when Babylon took over Mesopotamia. So the evidence then is that Genesis 1 predates those cosmic battles that were politically motivated. We can also look at the stylistic evidence in Genesis 1, the evidence for a priestly origin. There are many features which many people would agree are characteristic of a priestly source. The use of the word divine name Elohim, which is seen in other priestly sources in Genesis. systematic organization, 3 days of separation, 3 days of filling, lots of sevenfold word usages. For example, God saw that it was good. A special concern with the calendar, the creation of the sun and the moon as lights to mark seasons and days. And finally, of course, the Sabbath itself, that's a central priestly function, central priestly concern. Okay, so one sort of development of this whole idea will be the cosmic temple concept. There's a lot of terminology in not so much even Genesis 1, but other biblical texts, especially Job and the Psalms, building metaphors to describe the cosmos. Some of them are shown, right? The pillars of the earth and the sky and so on, the dome. Exodus specifically describes the lights of the sanctuary using very similar words to the lights of Genesis 1. So especially the lights, the sun and the moon, are key themes of the cosmic temple concept as proposed by Vogels and Walton. So in other words, Genesis 1 describes the inauguration of a cosmic sanctuary or temple from a priestly point of view. Yeah, so the question though is, where did the idea of a cosmic temple come from? Logically, there must be an earthly temple which inspires the concept of the cosmic temple, because otherwise it has no meaning. And the fourth commandment implies that this earthly temple predates the Exodus. So we should look for a Mesopotamian temple, which would be the earthly basis for the cosmic temple. So one possibility, say, is the temple of the God of Heaven at Uruk. Yeah, so this is an artist's impression of the temple around 3300 BC, and it's notable that of the gods of Mesopotamia, only one is validated later in the Bible. The God of Heaven is specifically affirmed in the book of Daniel as recognized as the high God of mankind. So this is a possibility for the kind of milieu which a priestly creation story could have come out of. So here's a particular piece of evidence in support of the very early recognition of the holiness of the seventh day. This is an archaic counting system from Uruk, which actually disappears around 3200 BC. And on this tablet, we read from the right to the left. Do I have a pointer here? Don't know, never mind. So this is an allotment, 2 times 7 purification priests for the Ziggurat Temple. The number there is a big circular indentation, and imposed on that is a little sign which means Lord, which it's not quite clear what the origin of the sign is, but it's very clear in Mesopotamian, in Sumerian literature, that sign means Lord. So the superimposition of that onto the number 7 to make the number 7 is indicative of something special, holy about the number 7. Okay, so that's kind of a bit of background. So now, what about creation and the flood? For more than 2,000 years, scholars have treated the flood as a kind of uncreation. It's a very well-known theme. And the idea is that uncreation turned the earth back into a chaotic state, primordial state. And then when the flood waters subsided, then the earth was recreated, and in a way that recapitulates creation. Yeah, these ideas led John Blenkinsop to actually name his book Creation, Uncreation, Recreation, to entitle his commentary. But in fact, they go back to the Dead Sea Scrolls. So we have for example, the Genesis Apocryphon and the paraphrase of Genesis and Exodus, they both make statements which embody this idea that there's a parallel between creation and recreation. Okay, so in the first one there, 4Q 4:22, the bits in brackets, of course, have been interpolated, right? So, no more will there be a flood to destroy the earth, the fixed times of day and night, the lights to shine on the heaven and the earth. So the red bit there is not in the interpolated bit. That's actually real, right? And the second quote, do not be afraid, O Noah, for I am with you and all your sons who will be like you forever of something of the earth and rule over all of them. So these two phrases, times of day and night and rule over all of them, are not in the Genesis account after the flood, but they have been taken by the writer of the Dead Sea Scroll and applied after the flood based on their use in the creation. So this is showing the idea that after the flood is like recreation. And we have some, these parallels have been explored in more detail, for example, Matthew's 1996. Okay, so we can say, going back to the state of the world before the first day, just as God's Ruach moved over the waters of the deep, so after the flood, God sends a Ruach over the flood waters to renew the earth. Same Hebrew word. Day two, just as God initially divided the waters to create the sky between them, then God regathers the flood waters, closing the apertures of the sky after the flood. Day three, just as God gathered the water in one place so that dry land would appear, so again the dry ground appears after the flood. And then days 4, 5, 6, 7, just as the sun and moon were placed in the heavens to mark seasons, days and years, then they reappear after flood to mark days and months. So slight change in wording, but the days occur in both accounts. Just as birds were created to fly above the earth, so the raven is released to fly back and forwards over the earth. Just as various kinds of living creatures were created, so these living creatures are called out of the ark. And finally, just as man, Adam, was first made in the image of God, so Noah is reinstated in the image of God. And then the seventh day, of course, God rests on the seventh day, but when Noah gives a sacrifice, then God smells the restful aroma in the Hebrew word. Okay, so we can see a very strong relationship between the creation and the flood story, but in which direction is the influence? Why do we assume that the creation story was the one that influenced the flood? It's actually backwards, because the retreat of a flood has to begin with a world of cosmic water. The creation doesn't have to begin with a world of water. The flood must end with rain ending, but the creation doesn't have to begin by separating water above and below the sky. The wane of the flood must involve the reappearance of dry land, but it'd be more logical for the creation of plants on day three of Genesis 1 to begin with rivers watering a desert, not a flood ending. So the conclusion then, Genesis 1 was inspired by the flood. Most likely, Genesis 1 is a series of visions that were inspired by the experience of the flood or the recounted story. These visions would not have contradicted science, but they were visions and they had to be expressed. So when they were not necessarily even written down, when they were mediated into words, then they were expressed in an ancient worldview. And because of that, they were destined eventually to contradict modern science. Yeah. Thank you.
Okay, we've got some time for questions. Yes. Comments.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, total it takes silence. Time
yeah.
to...
Yes.
Your point about the smelling of the sacrifice, isn't that also, like, I think it's in Enuma Elish, the gods got so excited by the aroma of the sacrifices being burned?
Well, yes, that's universal, we could say. But the particular parallel that's being drawn is the idea of it being restful. I mean, it's universal that the gods in the pagan gods depend on the sacrifice and so on, and the smell of the sacrifice. But it's specifically here the word for restful that's being drawn attention to as a parallel between Genesis 1 and the flood.
Okay. More questions? Dot.
Could you speak to points 2 and 4 of the hymn, just to clarify them in relation to each other?
Yeah, well, obviously these are claims or suggestions, if you like. So what I'm saying is, the statement in red is provable, if you like. The black lines are inferences. The inference is that since Genesis 1 came after the flood, it was inspired by the flood, and it is most, as I said at the very beginning, that if a man heard the divine words, let there be light, then he must have heard those in a vision. Seeing those visions, let's say over a period of 6 or 7 days, they were experiences, and there was no claim in those experiences as to how they happened. It was experiential, is what I'm arguing, and it was clearly an experience that was inspired by the flood. So, in other words, the things that happen, experiences, the stages in the experiences, are stages that are modeled on the flood, and that's the key to the meaning of the vision. And then afterwards, then that vision would have to be turned into words, and then when it's turned into words, then ideas maybe creep in that weren't in the vision. That's my
So you're not saying the visions have an accurate scientific account, but you say it didn't contradict. Okay, so that's a difference. It doesn't include black hole images in the vision, necessarily.
No, I'm saying that because the vision was inspired by the flood, its format was, its format was dictated by the nature of the flood, as being a recapitulation of the flood, and that's what gave it its form. It doesn't have anything to say about science as such, because the argument is it's the parallel with the flood that defines the nature of the vision as an experience, period.
Yeah. So if I may follow up, because it's the same thing I wanted to understand, but you're going from an assertion, and you have no evidence or anything. I mean, the visions didn't contradict you. That's based on, you're assuming it can't. But then you say it was destined to contradict modern science because they're written down. So what aspects was it? Are you really talking about the 7 days here? Are you talking about young Earth? Or are you talking about, what was it destined to contradict?
Well, that's a good question. I didn't think through that bit so clearly.
Okay. All right.
I was content with the first 95% of the
argument. I see. Sorry, we shouldn't have asked about the last 5%.
At the bottom line there.
All right, we got these visions. All right.
Can you comment briefly on the belief by many, especially of the number of creationists,
of the universality of the flood, that it's everywhere, it's completely over everything. It's the explanation for most of the sedimentary geological features that present in the dunes.
Right, well, that's definitely wrong.
Well, that's easy.
Yes. Right.
I will say, okay, so I've written a paper about it. It was published in the journal, and I'm following the argument of several other people, Calvin's argument, that it appeared to be a universal phenomenon to those who experienced it. So very briefly, Mesopotamia has got 100,000 square kilometers at least of flat land. When you're near the Euphrates, you can't actually see anything except flat land in every direction, and therefore you don't know, when you're Noah, you don't know that about anything else. There's no such thing as a globe because it hasn't been discovered. You just know that everything on the earth you know has been covered with water, and all the people who didn't get on your ark, which was a raft anyway, drowned. And the main point is that the date of the flood has been misunderstood. The date of the flood was earlier than has been widely believed, and therefore, when you move the flood back earlier in human history, human horizons are more limited. It's possible to believe, say, 5,500 BC, that Noah genuinely had no conception of the existence of the outside world beyond his small horizon. Yeah, and therefore, to him, it was genuinely a universal experience.
All right, I think we should thank the author again. Thank you very much.